Previously on Beta.
Then there's this one wire coming out of the system, so you plug that into the box. Whoa, did you see that? That can't be good. Look, sparks, no joke.
A rare Godzilla free day.
Blazing for eternity. Stop, stop. Knives sharp, sharp as knives. Pain, hurt, stop.
Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Today, author Tope Falerin joins us to talk about his debut novel, A Particular Kind of Black Man.
Somebody finally had the courage to come up and ask me why I was dirty all the time. And I was completely flummoxed because I thought, well, you know, I like taking baths and I don't think I'm dirty.
Also, filmmaker Don Coscarelli on his indie horror movie, Phantasm, which is still scaring film fanatics 40 years after its original release.
You know, as I was making the movie, I started to not worry so much about whether the audience was comprehending what I was doing exactly. And that's a risky thing to do. Thank God it worked out.
But first, Ginny Hogan. She's a writer and a stand-up comedian. There's an old saying in comedy that you shouldn't quit your day job, but that's just what Ginny did. Now she's a rising star in satire. Her work has been featured in The New Yorker, McSweeney's, and Vulture. Ginny's first book is out. It's called Toxic Femininity in the Workplace. In the book, she humorously explores the gender dynamics and challenges women face in the office. Beta's J. Carlisle Larson sat down to talk to Ginny about her book, her career path, and that day job she left.
I used to be an engineer, and the type of engineer I was a female engineer. That was my job title, and my job security. I don't mean to brag, but my coworkers thought I was very funny. They used to make this joke all the time because I was very lazy, and I would be like, I can't get fired. You can't fire female engineers. And I got called into HR one time, and the HR guy was like, Ginny, people are very upset about that joke. And I was like, look, the timing's not perfect. I need to work out the wording. I'll take a couple of mics. But he was like, no, people find it offensive. And I was like, okay, am I gonna get fired? And he was like, no, we don't fire female engineers.
You began your career as a data scientist in San Francisco. Not always the biggest leap from data scientist to comedy. How did you get from here to there?
I was working as a data scientist at a financial tech startup in San Francisco, and I was pretty bored, so I took a stand-up comedy class. I had been running this blog that was like ostensibly a data blog, but basically I just used it to make jokes about online dating. So I thought maybe stand-up would be like another way to get into comedy. But I really just thought it was going to like entertain me for a few months or so while I was bored at work. But I got very hooked on it. And from there, I kept doing stand-up. And then I eventually quit my job and started writing freelance.
I like that instead of doing what most people do when they're bored, which is just watch TV or shop online, and I'm talking about myself, you decided to do something slightly more productive, which is do something creative. Do you consider yourself, were you like a creative teenager before you got into tech, or was this something that kind of happened naturally from this blog that you had to write?
Yeah, I think I was pretty into sort of like the art of speaking as a teenager. I was very into my high school like speech team, and I liked the idea of trying to write something that was as condensed as possible, which I feel like is a lot of humor writing. But the humor side, definitely, I didn't really get into until like I was probably like 23 or so when I started writing this blog. So I got into it as an adult. But I definitely had that like passion for speaking publicly, which is good for stand-ups.
And you're really active on Twitter, which is a pretty condensed form of humor. How do you use that as an outlet a lot of the time? Because there are a lot of comedians on Twitter.
I love Twitter, and I originally started using it almost as like a practice for my stand-up bits, or if I had a joke that I thought I might put in a satire piece, but I wasn't sure if it would work. But then it kind of became its own, like an end in itself. I got very hooked on it, and it's so fun to just like get immediate feedback on jokes and to sort of be able to use so many different forms. Like, people, I mean, Twitter is like text-based, but you can do like videos and photos, and there's just so much different stuff. And all the memes are always taking different forms and everything. I just feel like it's like kind of constantly evolving, and you can make jokes in many different ways.
And I do want to get back to Twitter in just a little bit, but I want to look at how you got into comedy writing. And the first thing that you submitted was accepted by McSweeney's, which is a pretty big deal. Did you at the time know how big of a deal it was?
Yeah, I actually really didn't. And I, after that, had so many rejections from McSweeney's that I realized kind of that it was... The piece I submitted at first actually was sort of an offshoot of the data blog that I had mm-hmm. been running. It was like a statistical analysis of my happy birthday posts. And I had just quit my job and kind of had a lot of free time, and I was looking up humor blogs I could submit to, basically. But I feel I'm, like, very grateful that that piece got accepted, or I don't think I would have thought of writing satire as, like, a good option. Or I guess I was doing stand-up already, and I kind of wanted to do something else in comedy, but I didn't know exactly what it would be. And I think if not for that piece, I probably wouldn't have decided that satire was, like, a good route to go down.
You are in good company, both in the rejections and in the successes. So, you know, a good example of that is that piece for The New Yorker you did, The Examples of Toxic Femininity in the Workplace. It's now a book, but it did start as, you know, a piece for The New Yorker. How did you decide to, you know, what was the genesis of that piece?
The way The New Yorker's submission works is that you have to submit through an open inbox for a while, and they'll take like 3 to 4 months getting back to you. And I had just gotten an email from the editor, and she had said that the piece had been rejected, but she said I could submit straight to her, which meant it was going to kind of go a lot faster. So I kind of wanted something like very fresh. And it was at the beginning of the Me Too movement, and everyone was talking about toxic masculinity. So I made a reference to toxic femininity in conversation with a friend. And then I thought maybe I could try to, like, heighten it and turn it into a satire piece. But it was definitely one of the earlier ones that I wrote. But I spent a really long time on it because I thought it could be, like, based on the timing of the last rejection I'd gotten from The New Yorker, I thought it could be, like, a good opening.
You know, when this came out, did you hear from people saying, oh, my gosh, I've had that experience, but it didn't go naturally that way, but it still feels like I really identify with this?
Yeah, definitely. I think the one that or there are a few that people definitely like reference a lot. The one about kind of getting spoken over in meetings, I think there's a blurb about how like a woman gets or the one time she doesn't get spoken over, she doesn't actually have anything to say. And that one really like came from like very specific instances that I had in meetings where I was on this team at this financial tech startup, and it was like basically like 20 men and me. And I was so used to no one even like listening if I were to try to talk in meetings that I just basically stopped paying attention. And there was one time when the CTO like turned and asked me directly what I thought. And it was after like 2 years at this company, and I just had been paying no attention at all. So that I think like resonated with people, and definitely people like, kind of logically, what would happen if a company was all women is obviously like it's not supposed to be a suggestion that we shouldn't have men in the workplace or whatever. But I think there are a lot of women who are working with a lot of men and sort of like to think about the idea of having more women on their team, basically, just because it could be like kind of a more amicable workplace for them.
I used to work with all men. It was like me and 20 men. And my friends used to ask like, oh, you must get hit on all the time you work with all men. But the truth is that if you're in a group of people that's like 70% men, 30% women, the women get hit on all the time. If it's almost 100% men, the men just behave as if there are no women. At least that's what I told myself.
So let's talk about the book, which was sort of a jumping off point from your piece in The New Yorker. How did you approach expanding this out?
It was like a really fun process. I was contacted by an editor at HarperCollins, and she wanted to talk about kind of what direction she thought a book could take of this form. And there were kind of like a few different directions we were looking at first, whether it would be sort of more personal essays and kind of like more serious stories of times I had in tech. But I love humor writing, and that's definitely what I had the most background in. And I had many ideas for sort of separate pieces that could be in a book like this. So we decided on doing a humor book of basically like short satirical pieces for women in the workplace. So from there, we basically started brainstorming what the pieces in the book would be and how many there would be. I worked with an illustrator. She was really great and kind of figuring out like which pieces would have illustrations, what forms the illustrations would take. There are some pieces that are more heavily illustrated, so sometimes the joke is in the illustrations as well. And that was, it was all like a really fun process to figure out kind of what format the book would take.
When you were writing this book, some of, you know, the essays aren't, they're funny, but they're also a little bit dark. I would say that the piece about being noise-canceling headphones might have some resonance with some people. You know, how do you find the balance between acknowledging some really messed up work dynamics plus humor here?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, that the noise-canceling headphones, that definitely came out of in my job, I had noise-canceling headphones, and people were always sort of like rubbing, not always, but it happened on several occasions that someone was like kind of rubbing my back, and there was really no reason to. The noise-canceling headphones didn't even really work, so if they had just said my name, I would have heard them. So I wanted it to be, I mean, I think the subject matter is dark, and I think sexism in the workplace is dark, so I definitely didn't want it to be entirely lighthearted. I guess in terms of figuring out, like, how to balance it, I think it's always important to keep in mind sort of who I'm making fun of at any given point. So as long as the person who, like, in the headphone piece, as long as the target of the joke is the person who's kind of behaving inappropriately and who's touching someone just because they have noise-canceling headphones on, I think that's sort of the goal to always keep in mind rather than trying to make, at any point, make, like, the woman the target of the joke.
I hesitate to ask this question. I'm just curious, given that part of what we've been talking about is, you know, your experience in the tech world and that being a really gendered place. And, you know, stand-up still has kind of a reputation of being a little bit of a boys' club. Have you run into any, not resistance necessarily, but have you found it sometimes a little weird breaking in, or have you, you know, had an okay time trying to make that jump?
Yeah, I think it's a very challenging environment to write for a website or a magazine. You don't have to really go out and interface with someone who might be, like, sexually harassing you, whereas in stand-up you often do. So in stand-up you have to kind of go to open mics and anyone is allowed to go, and there's no oversight. It's pretty hard to kick someone out of doing stand-up, so there are a lot of, like, people who make it a very negative environment for women. I mean, there are so many funny women, and I think that there's, like, kind of a growing demand for them, and that it no longer feels like someone is being sectioned off as being, like, a female comedian, mm-hmm. you know? Like, I think that a lot of these women have very general appeal. So I think that, yeah, I would say I'm, like, optimistic about the future. I think for someone starting out in stand-up and the way that people at, like, open mics or small shows with newer comedians behave around their other comedians could definitely be improved upon, because I think that that's sort of where there's absolutely no oversight. And I think a lot of women probably drop off early because of having, like, negative experiences before they've gotten any traction. Whereas someone who's further along might have a very negative experience with a comedian who is harassing them in some way, but they have already invested so much time and made progress, so they are kind of more willing to keep going forward.
Now that you are doing this full time, you're submitting freelance pieces, you're doing stand-up, you know, what do you see as kind of your course here moving forward? What is it that you want to be doing now more that you have time to actually do it?
I really want to be a humor writer in any capacity, pretty much. I definitely want to write more books. I'd love to write novels, and I'd love to write additional humor books. When I started in stand-up, I had kind of a very narrow career goal, there were only a few different paths I saw forward, whereas now I think my goal is to just create stuff that's funny and feels true to my voice, and I'm happy to write for other people's shows. I also have ideas for, like, shows I'd want to create myself. But yeah, any sort of, like, humor writing is kind of what I want to do in the future.
Yeah, and as we spoke about a little bit earlier, you are very active on Twitter. It's where you kind of workshop a lot of your jokes. And you're also really open about things going on in your life on Twitter with sort of a humorous bent. Have you found that that has resonated with, I guess, Twitter citizens in many ways?
I think for me, a big part of comedy has been that I'm no longer embarrassed to talk about things I used to be embarrassed to talk about. So Twitter kind of represents, like, I don't really feel like there's any reason I should be hiding, like, the way I feel about a lot of things. Like, I don't have any desire to, like, hide my political views or, like, hide my kind of any sort of like mental health issues. So I Twitter definitely, like, if I can think of a joke on a subject, I don't really, there aren't that many subjects I think of as being off limits.
Katie Holmes comes in, Robbie and Smoothie Bar. She orders three of the same kind of smoothie. She sips all three of them, and then she throws two of them away, even though they all taste exactly the same. Isn't that wild? Like, can you imagine being so crazy? That you can imagine. So crazy that you dig through the trash for Katie Holmes's rejected smoothies. Seriously, I could not taste the difference, you know? Like, what does she know that I don't know? It must be some sort of Scientology thing.
It would only be off limits if it were about someone else. As long as it's personal to me, I feel like I am pretty willing to share it.
Jenny, thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you so much. This was awesome.
Jenny Hogan is a writer, stand-up comedian, and the author of Toxic Femininity in the Workplace. She talked with Beta's J. Carlisle Larson. Find out more about Jenny at our workplace, wpr.org/beta.
Personally, I have always had a genuine fear and concern about what happens after you die, shared with probably every other member of my species.
Filmmaker Don Coscarelli joins us to talk about his indie horror film, Phantasm. That's coming up in just a moment. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta on Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome back to Beta on Wisconsin Public Radio. Don Coscarelli is the youngest filmmaker ever to have a feature film distributed by a major studio. He was only 19 years old when he sold his critically acclaimed film, Jim, the World's Greatest, to Universal Pictures. But it was Don's third film that put him on the map, the indie horror movie, Phantasm. Don wrote, shot, directed, and edited it. Phantasm was released in 1979 and spawned four sequels. The film is now considered a cult classic and has appeared on many critics' lists of best horror films.
Somebody once told me that horror films make money. It's funny because today that's absolutely the truth, because some of the most successful films are the horror and genre films. But at any rate, I got this bug in my mind that maybe my next film, I need to do something a little more commercial. And mm-hmm. So I decided to try doing horror.
Yeah, and that was a great decision. Your third film, probably your best-known film, the 1979 horror film Phantasm, which, speaking of getting back to this idea of doing all this work, you wrote, directed, shot it, and edited it. For those of our listeners who aren't familiar with it, can you give us a brief synopsis of Phantasm without revealing too many, if any, preferably no spoilers?
Well, basically, it's a pretty simple story about a 12-year-old boy who lives with his older brother, who's a little older, about 20s, and these two brothers are recent orphans. Their parents have died, and so the younger brother is really trying to come to grips with the loss of the parents and potential loss of his brother who wants to leave. And so, he has an active imagination, but he might just be the sharpest knife in the drawer in that town. And he starts to notice some strange things going on. There's a series of murders. One of their friends is killed. There's a funeral up at this odd mortuary cemetery complex called Morningside. And our hero, Mike, witnesses some strange things and notices this strange, very enigmatic and sinister mortician.
Yeah, played by Angus Scrimm, yeah.
The funeral is about to begin, sir.
And he and his brother and their neighborhood friend, who's the ice cream vendor, played by Reggie Bannister, get involved in trying to learn what the nature is going on up here, and pretty soon it takes some really strange, frightening turns.
Mm-hmm. So where did you get the idea for Phantasm?
Well, that's a really good story. Truthfully, I had attended a few funerals in my young age, and it was just remarkable to me the way our society deals with death. Mm-hmm. I mean, personally, I have always had a genuine fear and concern about what happens after you die, shared with probably every other member of my species. you know, this imagery that goes on in the way that we treat, because it's different in other societies, but here, you know, there's this strange practice of men dressed in dark suits, and they're in these mausoleums, and you give them the dead body of your deceased relative, and it goes away into sort of a, I don't know, experimentation or scientific operating lab, and then the corpse comes back looking kind of like your relative, but not exactly, mm-hmm. and, you know, long funeral coaches, all this imagery, really good stuff, and I thought, this would be a great setting for a horror film. Combined with the fact that favorite sci-fi movie from the 50s I loved, it was called Invaders from Mars, mm-hmm. and that had a storyline where there was a kid where there was a Martian ship landed in his backyard, but nobody believed this boy when he told them that he saw it. And I thought that idea of having a kid who saw strange things, but he was the only one pretty much on his own to try to figure out the nature of it.
I was messing around up at Morningside Cemetery, and I saw something. Something really scary.
What was all in your mind?
And not really knowing it, but I ended up making a mashup of horror, fantasy, and science fiction.
Yeah. Wasn't part of the storyline of Phantasm, the Chrome Sphere, didn't the idea for that part of the story come from a dream you had when you were 15 years old? Is that right?
Yeah, absolutely true. It's maybe one of the only dreams I've remembered vividly enough to put into a film, but I'd had a dream where I was just being pursued down long corridors by this silver chrome orb. And it stuck with me. And while I was writing Phantasm, I thought, well, this would be an interesting device to try to work into the story. And so I did. And at the time, never having any idea what kind of an impact that would have, because that image of the sphere and the way that the sphere, it's a, you know, without giving away too much, it becomes a deadly killing device. And the impact of that sequence really woke audiences up.
Oh, yeah.
And a lot of people never forgot it. You know, we'll be introduced to people and they go, oh, you did Phantasm. Oh, yeah, I don't know if I know that movie. And then all I have to do is just put my hand with a couple fingers out. I go, you know, the one with the ball, like yeah. that. And they immediately remember.
Yeah, it's very appropriate. That dream inspiration is very appropriate because Phantasm, the way it plays out, like the first time I saw it, I thought, wow, this is, you know, so much like a nightmare, very surreal and very dreamlike. And I would even say that Phantasm and David Lynch's Eraserhead are two of the best cinematic representations of a nightmare that I've ever seen. Did you always know that Phantasm was going to rely heavily on dream logic, or was that something that just developed as you were writing the screenplay?
You know, first off, thank you for that praise and lumping me in with David Lynch, because, wow, am I in awe of his work. I was, you know, a little younger, a little more confident, possibly, like the young are, and mm-hmm. I was willing to take some risks and tell this story in a different kind of style. And, you know, as I was making the movie, I started to not worry so much about whether the audience was comprehending what I was doing exactly. And that's a risky thing to do. Thank God it worked out. But I do think that by having it grounded with some real elemental scares throughout, kept audiences' attention.
You made this film in the late 1970s before CGI. So how did you achieve the special effects of the silver orb zooming around the funeral parlor?
Well, truthfully, cellophane tape and a lot of fishing line. You know, we did everything the old-fashioned way. Special effects, well, they're much like magic tricks. I mean, you have to, for a very short period of time, create an illusion that works. And if you just break it up into its component parts, a lot of times each little component is doable. Mm-hmm. It's just trying to do it all at once is where nowadays they do these effects all at once and have characters morph into other characters all through these very complicated digital effects. But for instance, with that flying sphere, we had to figure out a way to make the thing fly. And, you know, we tried a lot of exotic things with piano wire and that, none of that worked. And, you know, somebody at some point just said, well, why don't you just chuck the damn thing? Mm-hmm. And it was right on. And for that particular shot, we just had somebody throw the sphere, but we shot it in reverse and in slow motion.
Yeah.
And that created the effect. When we wanted it to round a corner, we could use fishing line and put it on a little string and have it whip around that way. So it was a function of, you know, simplifying and then just trying to figure out an innovative way of making that little small effect work.
You had a really dangerous experience while you were working on Phantasm, didn't you?
Well, I had a lot of them. You know, in my book, True Indie, I mentioned a couple. We had to do some, I shot a sequence with a car chase, and in the chase, the lead star had to pop up through the sunroom with a shotgun. And I wanted to get a close, intimate shot, so I was riding in the trunk. You know, again, being young, being ignorant, didn't know that even when you're shooting with blank charges, that they are dangerous. And there have been cases after that time, you know, where actors had actually died from being too close to the proximity of a blank pistol.
Oh, dear.
Yeah, and so anyway, so I was like 2 feet away from a shotgun loaded with blank shells, and the actor was just doing his great action hero stuff, shooting right at me with the camera. And to protect my face, we put this camera pad over my face and taped it on, figuring it with some aluminum foil, figuring if anything came out, that would protect it. And it did. It's just that all this burning stuff hit the pad and lit it on fire. And then there was this mad dash to try to pull this burning pad off my face before it torched my skin, which thank God we were able to.
Yeah, that's very fortunate, yeah. The music and the sound design in Phantasm are a big part of the film's success. Can you talk a bit about that?
Yeah, sure can. I was lucky enough on my very first film to meet a terrific composer, super talented man named Fred Miro. And Fred teamed up with a friend of his named Malcolm Seagrave, and the two of them crafted this really beautiful, insidious theme that just became the icon of Phantasm, is this little 8-note theme mm-hmm. that he created. It was so powerful and so important. What was wonderful about Fred and Malcolm also is that both of them were really unconventional composers. I mean, both of them had come up through classical music. Fred was an apprentice to Leonard Bernstein at the New York Philharmonic.
Wow.
Oh, yeah, and he'd had a Guggenheim Fellowship and all kinds of things. But he also loved to produce rock bands. So he was writing these wonderful symphonic pieces and also, you know, producing some pretty hardcore rock stuff. So when they came to approach doing Phantasm, they were really interested in working with unusual instruments. And that was really cool stuff. I mean, there's a chase scene that's completely scored to Indian tablas. One of their favorite tools, you know, in some of the really scary parts is they would take a drumstick and scrape it across a cymbal, and you'd get these weird kind of sound. And frequently they'd use that whenever the tall man was going to appear. But a lot of unconventional, out-of-the-box thinking that enhanced this soundtrack that was so important.
Here it is, 40 years since Phantasm has been released. It's become a cult classic. It often appears on critics' lists of the best horror films. Why do you think the film has struck a chord with so many people?
My opinion has evolved over the years, because one of the cool parts about working in the horror genre is that there's a very passionate fan. Some people call them cult.
Yes.
But I call them passionate. They're passionate fans. And the fans congregate at these horror conventions and very much online. So I'm constantly getting feedback as to why. So let me give you a few of the reasons why Phantasm is. I think number one is the basic theme of the movie, which is, what happens when you die? I mean, this is a universal question that everyone on this planet at one point or another thinks about. And it's a pretty strange and surreal answer to that question.
Yeah.
Number two, there's a really strong familial bond in the film that has to do with, you know, loss of the parents and being orphaned, about this tight brotherhood relationship. And they almost have a third brother in this character of Reggie, the ice cream man.
Yeah, that's true.
And it's these three heroes are allied against the forces of evil. You know, it's very strong. But there's one other element to its success that I've learned about in recent years, Doug, is that I meet so many young men who are in their 30s, 40s, and 50s, and they always tell me, you know, when I saw that movie, I just never forgot it because there was that kid, and he was shooting a shotgun. He was driving his brother's car. He was fighting the undead in a weird way, and not by any design. I created this teen male empowerment movie.
Don Coscarelli is the man behind the indie horror movie Phantasm and the author of True Indie: Life and Death in Filmmaking. His other films include The Beastmaster and Bubba Hotep. Learn more about Don and his films at wpr.org/beta.
You think that when you die, you go to heaven. You come to us.
You know, you just heard Don Coscarelli talk about how influential Phantasm was, and that got us thinking about the films that really scared us. So we thought we'd have a beta roundtable to talk about it. I want to welcome J. Carlisle Larson back into the studio. Great job with the Ginny Hogan interview, JCL.
Thank you, Doug.
Also, technical director Steve Gotcher joins us.
Hello.
Hi, Steve. JCL, let's start with you. What is the scariest horror movie you've ever seen?
So this is not a horror film, but it scared the crap out of me. And I think some of it could have been situational, but Close Encounters of the Third Kind really, really freaked me out. A little background. At the time I was watching it, I was probably around 6 or 7, getting a perm in my living room. And I was trapped there because my mom was doing the perm, watching the movie. Couldn't escape, had to watch all of it, and it really freaked me out. So it could have been fumes, could have been the movie, but it was definitely terrifying. Cannot watch it to this day.
Wait a second, he's heading right for my windshield. The traffic is approaching head on. Alter right, and really moving. And right by us, right now. That was really close.
Wow. Could have been the fumes, could have been the movie, could have been a combination.
Probably. I also lived in Nevada, which was like in the 90s was like the height of like UFO stuff. So it was also very spooked.
Wow.
So that is my horror film scare time.
All right.
Zone.
Thank you for sharing that. An unpredictable pick
do what
from
I can.
JCL. And you do a lot. And let's turn it over to
I
Steve Gotcher.
I find Richard Dreyfuss to be pretty scary.
Yeah.
I got to say.
And the mashed potatoes in the shape of, what is it? Devil's Tower?
Devil's Tower. Yep.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Steve. Your favorite?
Well, when I was a kid, around 10 years old, I lived in Los Angeles, and there was this Saturday afternoon show that featured old horror movies and science fiction movies called Strange Tales of Science Fiction. And so my cousins and I lived next door to each other, and we always got together at one or the other's house on Saturday and watched Strange Tales of Science Fiction. And one afternoon, they showed Invasion of the Body Snatchers. With Kevin McCarthy.
The original version, yes. Not the Donald Sutherland remake. Right.
It was film noir, and I didn't know what film noir was. It didn't mean anything to me. But it was just kind of was the kind of film that just sort of made you feel very uncomfortable. The way it was shot, the way it was, the way the dialogue went. But the final scene in the film, when Kevin's character, Miles Benelli, kisses Dana Winter, who is the character Becky, and he lifts up from her and realizes she's not who she was when he left her before, and then runs out of the cave and runs out to the freeway and is screaming,
"You're here already! You're next!
I couldn't sleep that whole night. It was terrible.
Yeah, that's a great film. Have you ever read the novel, Jack
I have
Finney?
Not.
The novel is great, too. Those are
I
both
will have
excellent
to do that.
Choices.
Of course you read the novel.
Of course, yeah. Have
and
I
you
seen
haven't
the
seen the film.
No, I've seen the original, but I haven't seen the remake.
Doug.
Oh, yeah. But I mean, it's scariest. It's kind of obvious. I wish it wasn't so obvious, but I think I have to go with it because of the impact it had when I saw it. Was Alfred Hitchcock's 1960 classic Psycho.
She just goes a little mad sometimes. We all go a little mad sometimes.
Based on the novel by Robert Bloch, who, of course, is from Milwaukee, our executive producer, showrunner, Adam Friedrich's hometown. And just because I've been a Hitchcock fan for years, and just the way, well, for one thing, it's one of the most iconic scores, the Bernard Herrmann score, just all strings and the famous shower scene, sting, and just the audacity that Hitchcock had to kill off Janet Leigh's character, Marion Crane, at the end of the first act, about 47 minutes into the film. A fun fact about Psycho, of course, is that Ted Knight, from Caddyshack and the Mary Tyler Moore Show, Ted Baxter appears. He's the police officer that brings the blanket to Norman at the very end. The film still holds up in my humble
opinion.
Doesn't
he have the line, Norman, we're waiting?
No, he does.
Oh, wait, I'm getting my movies.
Yeah, yeah, and you think Gus Van Sant in that remake, that shot-for-shot remake in color with Vince Vaughn as Norman Bates?
No.
Bad idea.
No.
Okay, well, thank you, J. Carlisle Larson.
Thank you.
And thank you, Steve Gotcher.
You're welcome.
This has been a Beta Roundtable. No horror movies were harmed in the making of this segment. We'd like to know what the scariest horror movie you've ever seen is. Hit us up on Twitter, @WPRBeta, or send us an email, beta@WPR.org.
I know that one core important part of my identity is that I'm an artist, and that centers me in a way that nothing else has before.
Tope Falerin tells us about his debut novel, A Particular Kind of Black Man. That's coming up on Beta on Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Doug Gordon, and you're listening to Beta on Wisconsin Public Radio. Tope Falerin is a Nigerian-American writer. He won the Kane Prize for African Writing in 2013 and earned 2 master's degrees as a Rhodes Scholar. Tope's debut novel is called A Particular Kind of Black Man. It's about a Nigerian family living in Utah and the challenges they face in adapting to American life.
The epigraph is task to be where I am. Even when I'm in this solemn and absurd role, I am still the place where creation works on itself. It's from a poem called Guard Duty by Tomas Tranströmer. And Tomas Tranströmer is one of my favorite artists, certainly one of my favorite writers. I guess it would have been about 10 years ago now. I was deep into my poetry phase. I was at a point in my life when I was convinced that I would spend the rest of my life writing poetry. And I was just reading a lot of poetry. And I came across Tomas Tranströmer's work, and it just struck me like a bolt of lightning. I had one of those experiences that my father's a very religious person, and he'd often told me that when you're saved, you know, you just kind of feel this, you know, sort of energy run through you, and everything changes. And I really hadn't had that feeling in a religious context, but when I first read Tranströmer's work, I did, just because he seemed to speak about things that I had been thinking about for much of my life. So anyway, this poem in particular is one that I cherish and I hold very close to my heart, primarily because it's about the act of creation. And I just think there's something incredibly beautiful about the notion that creation is working on itself within us, you know, that none of us are finished and that we're evolving. And so that's the reason why I chose that epigraph.
That's great. Thank you. Thank you for sharing that. Can you give us a synopsis of your novel, A Particular Kind of Black Man, without revealing any spoilers?
Yeah, of course. So the novel centers on a character named Tunde Akinola. He's born and raised in Utah, and his parents are from Nigeria. And his father comes to America to go to college and subsequently earns his degree. And around the time that Tunde is 6, his mother becomes ill. She starts to experience some kind of mental illness. As a result of that, she becomes sick, and she at one point takes Tunde and his brother Tayo away from their home to a shelter and becomes sicker and eventually leaves to go back to Nigeria. So Tunde and Tayo are left with their father. And so the book is about how, you know, Tunde's kind of coming of age, how he experiences life, and also about how he constructs his identity over the course of the early part of his life.
Now would be a great time to have you read an excerpt from your book. And if you could set it up for us, that would be great.
Of course. So this is from the beginning of the book. It's the moment when Tunde starts school. He's been looking forward to school for quite some time. He kind of senses that school is a place where maybe he can begin to figure things out about life and himself, and he's eager to learn about the world, and so he's really excited about it. I started school on September 7th, 1987, a few weeks before I turned six. I was ecstatic because I'd spent much time watching the kids in my neighborhood trip past my bedroom window with books under their arms and bags on their backs, like they were departing for another world. I dimly sensed that at school I could become something more than a brother or son, that each day I went, I would come back carrying knowledge that was mine alone. My family walked with me to school that first day. I remember the principal extending her hand when I met her. I shyly extended mine as well, and as we shook hands, she said, "We are very happy that you're here." It was in her eyes, the way she looked at me, like I was something scary and unknown. That's how I knew I was different. On the playground, all my classmates asked if they could touch my hair. I said okay. Then Simon rubbed my skin and ran away crying to the playground attendant. "It won't come off," he wailed. "Why won't it come off?" I was too tired after school to ask my father any questions, too excited about everything I had just experienced. But the next day, after another kid rubbed my arm until it was raw, I asked my father why my hair was so kinky and why I couldn't wash the brown off my skin. He shook his head and frowned. He began talking about the importance of pride, the meaning of self-respect, but I didn't really understand what he was saying.
That was great. Thank you. So where did this idea of a kid trying to rub the brown off of Tunde's skin come from?
Yeah, it's an amalgamation of stories. So I experienced something similar when I was quite young, growing up in Utah. It didn't quite happen this way. But I remember when I was young, kind of coming into awareness of the fact that I had, you know, that I was different than other people, that I had a different skin color. Before then, I was, you know, kind of blissfully unaware and just really excited about going to school and getting a larger sense of the way the world worked and learning things. And then all of a sudden, I'm confronted with the fact that there's something that I had never thought about before that separated me from my peers. I've also had conversations with friends who grew up in similar contexts and predominantly white environments, and they all report having similar things happen to them and having this kind of visceral realization that there was something profoundly different, or at least that society said there was something profoundly different from them with other people. And so I just wanted to capture that kind of narrative for the story because I think it's an essential piece in beginning to discuss why Tunde feels so isolated and different from the rest of the world.
How much of your novel is based on your own life experience?
Yeah, a lot of it is. At least the beginning parts are, more or less, you know, come from my experiences. To be perfectly frank, when I started writing this, I wasn't quite sure what I was writing. I thought, maybe I'm writing about my life, or maybe I'm writing fiction, and I just thought, I'll sit down and write and see what happens. And the thing that happened is that the more I wrote, the more that Tunde's life began to diverge in a very substantial way from mine. So the broad outlines of his life are similar to mine. He grew up in Utah. I did as well. He spent his high school years in Texas. I did as well. He went to Morehouse College. I did as well. But the way he responds to various situations, the way he responds is different than I responded to those situations. And the more I wrote, the more I felt a kind of life pulsing on the page that differed in substantial ways from my own. So it is a work of fiction, but I think I wanted to write from a very vulnerable place as well in order to, you know, sort of ensure that there was some life on the page when somebody else picks up the book to read it. So I did draw from my life at certain points to ensure that was the case.
Yeah. I read a very interesting quote from you recently when I was preparing for this interview. You said that the protagonist of your novel is forced to construct a persona because the persona that he inherits from his father and from society doesn't match who he actually is. Can you talk a bit about how Tunde goes about constructing that persona?
Yeah, absolutely. So this is something that many first-generation American kids experience, especially first-generation kids whose parents are from, you know, let's say Africa or who are people of color. He's born into this society that says, okay, because of the way you look, you are this person or you are like these people. And his father, very proud father, is from Nigeria and says, no, you're a Nigerian and that's who you are and always will be. And as he grows up, he finds that none of these identities quite fit him. And so he has to go through this very arduous process of deciding who he is. And his father has a plan for him. His father says, you know, based on my study, there is a particular kind of black man in this country who is successful. and that's a black man who speaks a certain kind of way, who likes certain kinds of things. And so Tunde tries his very best to fit that mold. His father is quite fond of people like Sidney Poitier and, you know, other sort of high-achieving black people who are admired by mainstream, which is to say white society.
Yeah, Hakeem Olajuwon, the basketball player, being another one.
Yeah, and so that's the ideal that Tunde has in his mind as he grows up. And there's a certain point in the novel where he finally confronts this idea. He finally confronts himself and says, okay, well, I suppose in one way my father was right because I'm successful. I'm academically successful. People seem to, you know, want me to do well in life. But I'm not quite sure if this persona I've constructed actually has anything to do with what's happening inside me. And furthermore, the only reason I constructed this persona is to satisfy everyone else. What about me? How am I going to live a fulfilled life if I'm living the rest of my life to satisfy other people? So he starts this journey of trying to figure out who he is. And Tunde does this by writing, by trying to create art, actually. And that's what the novel becomes. It becomes him actually sitting down and writing about his life. And in the end, trying to write a future for himself, the kind of future that he can inhabit and be fully himself. And so that becomes the thrust of the novel as the novel proceeds.
Would you say that you yourself have had to construct your own persona?
1,000%. And I didn't do so in the elegant, a way that Tunde eventually does. My process of constructing my identity was more difficult. You know, when I was in college, I sensed that I had to be a particular kind of black man, and I didn't question that at all. I just tried my very best to be successful. And it wasn't for me until I actually went to grad school. I was fortunate enough to go to Oxford on a Rhodes Scholarship, and I spent 2 years in Oxford, and that was the most important period of my life because for the first time in my life, I wasn't trying to satisfy anyone. I wasn't trying to sort of excel in the classroom because Oxford's academic system is very different. You have a tutorial that you have once a week, and then your exams are at the end. So you have all this time to basically, you know, walk around and read and figure yourself out. And so for me, I was able to sort out a lot of questions that I'd been grappling with my entire life.
And when you were at Oxford studying for your master's degree, you were working on a thesis about identity, right?
That's exactly it, yeah.
Can you tell me a bit about that?
Yeah, so I became enamored with this idea. I did my second master's in African studies, and my thesis was on identity construction.
Mm.
And so I was researching this idea that identity in the African context has evolved over the course of the 20th century. So before the colonial period, people in Africa thought of themselves differently. They thought of themselves according to what kind of ethnic grouping they were a part of or what town they emerged from, who their people were, that sort of thing. And then colonialism happens and the Berlin Conference, where Europeans decide to, you know, kind of carve up Africa. And so all of a sudden, Africans begin to think of themselves according to the countries that, you know, have been assigned to them by the Europeans. They're Nigerians, they're Ghanaians, they're South Africans, what have you. And then by the mid-1960s, there's this wave of independence movements, and identity evolves again in the African context. And then by the time I'm at Oxford thinking about this, we have the web. Mm. And so you have people who are going online and identifying themselves differently and saying, well, I'm a Nigerian, or I'm a Nigerian-American, or I'm British-Nigerian. And they have the power to kind of say, well, this is who I am. You know, that's divorced from what history or colonialism has said about them. And so I became, you know, obviously there was a kind of, you know, personal reason why I was deeply interested in this. And I spent a lot of time interviewing people about their identities and where they came from and why they identified the way they did. And the thing that I discovered was that I think in the 21st century, the thing that's so exciting is that we all have the option of constructing our own identities. And we do so all the time. The moment you get on Facebook and create a profile, or if you go on a dating website or an app and create a profile, you are, you know, sort of emphasizing certain things about yourself and de-emphasizing other things. And so we all do this all the time. And I wanted to write a book that captured what it would be like to do this from the beginning of your life, you know, and not knowing that you have an option and wanting and struggling with the things that every other kid struggles with, which is, how do I fit in? How do I become acceptable? All while you're trying to come up with an identity that fits who you actually are inside.
Yeah, that's fascinating. In a profile that I just recently read, it was a profile from 2013, you said that you've been having the same conversation your whole life about where do you fit. Now, yeah. It's 6 years later and you've published your debut novel. Are you any closer to knowing the answer to the question of where do you fit?
I think so. I think that part of it is, I know that one core important part of my identity is that I'm an artist, and that centers me in a way that nothing else has before. I'm an artist, and I create art, and I interact with art, and that's very important to me. I think the other thing, and the most important thing is that I have a family, that I'm married and I have a 2-year-old, and having a family has really done wonders for me in terms of like sort of rooting me, certainly in a family, in this kind of unit that I belong to. Those two things have been really important to me.
Tope Fallaron, thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Tope Fallaron is the author of A Particular Kind of Black Man. Head over to WPR.org/beta to find out more about Tope. That does it for this edition of Beta. Thanks to our guests, Ginny Hogan, Don Coscarelli, and Tope Fallaron. If you want to hear it again or binge on past episodes, subscribe to the Beta podcast via iTunes or wherever you catch your favorite pods. Beta is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Red Meat Productions.
Fantastic!
A very special thanks to J. Carlisle Larson.
First of all, JC, I want to congratulate you on a great, great success.
Our music and technical director is Steve Gotcher.
Now what is this, Steve? A little while ago it was driving backwards. Now it's monsters.
Our executive producer is Adam Friedrich.
Well, you haven't seen this Adam thing. He's the Terminator without the bashful charm.
And thanks to you, our alphas. Until next week, I'm Doug Gordon.
It won't make the slightest difference to me, Doug. But the consequences to you would be devastating.